Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, and my producer is Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence, write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show is devoted to the new Hemingway Library edition of The Old Man and the Sea, the novella that seems to be a constant touchstone on our show, no matter what the topic of the episode may be. So One True Podcast is tremendously lucky to have with us to talk about this new publication, its editor, Sean Hemingway. Sean Hemingway is the John A. and Carol O. Moran Curator in Charge of the Department of Greek and Roman Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. A specialist in Greek and Roman bronze sculpture and a classical archaeologist, he is the author of numerous publications on ancient art, as well as a novel entitled The Tomb of Alexander. The grandson of Ernest Hemingway, he is the editor of Hemingway on Hunting and Hemingway on War, the restored edition of A Movable Feast, and six other books of his grandfather's writings, which comprise the popular Hemingway Library Edition series. And I have them all. I have to add that. So welcome to One True Podcast, Sean. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here with you.
Well, Sean, just in reading the bio, a thought occurred to me. I'm sure this begs the question. So you obviously have other interests and other trainings. I'm sure you'd be proud that of your grandfather's work, but it's not automatic that you would necessarily like it. So do you enjoy getting your hands dirty in the manuscript and thinking about his work all the time?
I've really enjoyed doing these different projects on my grandfather's works. It's been a real privilege and pleasure for me to have the opportunity to work with, especially with his original manuscripts, which are housed at the Kennedy Library in Boston. So yeah, no, I really have enjoyed it. And I think as you mentioned, my own personal career and training is also an academic one. And so I'm used to the kind of scholarly approach. And so it's been fascinating for me to be able to do that with my own grandfather's works.
So you would be a Hemingway fan, even if you weren't a Hemingway?
You know, I think so for sure. I really love his writing. And now I've had a chance really to read just about all of it. And I really am I'm a big fan and a big admirer.
Well, we were talking about in the bio, this tremendous series of the Hemingway Library Edition. So what is behind that? Is this a copyright issue, or do you and the family just want to have as much material out and available to the public? What's the motivation?
It really kind of started with A Movable Feast, the restored edition that I worked on of A Movable Feast, working with my uncle, Patrick Hemingway, who is the sole surviving son of Ernest Hemingway, and my dad's older brother. And so, you know, Patrick wanted to revisit that work. And then we spent a lot of time on that and did a very careful new edition of it. And it was controversial with some people because it's such a beloved work, but it was also very successful, I think, and showed how rich the archives are at the Kennedy Library. Patrick is really the leader of the Hemingway literary estate, and working with him Simon & Schuster, which publishes Hemingway's works now, taking on from Scribner's, we decided to do a series, the Hemingway Library Edition, and kind of calling it that after the rich materials that are in the Kennedy Library in Boston, where the Hemingway collection is held as part of the National Archives. And it has been a really successful series. I think we've done six books now, and there's just such a rich, it's rich material that's related specifically to the books, but then there's a lot of also supplementary material, sometimes photographs, images of manuscripts, and then related works, and some of those are sometimes unpublished. So it's been a fascinating pastime.
Sean, you're drawing a distinction between the phrase restored edition and the other books in the Hemingway Library series. You must have used that phrase intentionally. So was there something about a movable feast that is distinct from the others?
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. So in a movable feast, was actually a posthumously published work by my grandfather. It was published, after his death. And at the time that it was published, it was promoted as complete. But part of the review of it showed very clearly that it actually was not complete. And there were all these chapters that had been edited out. What I did with that project was actually working with the last manuscript that my grandfather had been working on. We really worked closely and used that manuscript. And then we included all these other chapters as supplementary chapters. And so it showed that the restored edition really shows how the book looked at the time of his death. And he had a hard time completing that book. And that's different than the Hemingway Library editions, which have really focused on his published works, the works that were completed during his lifetime. And so for those, he really, he was a master. He had, of course, editors at Scribner's, but he was a master writer. When he considered something finished, we have not tinkered with that, except for the occasional typo. So that's the distinction there.
There is something sacrosanct about the original Immovable Feast that was published in 1964. And it's like, well, that's it. That's the Immovable Feast that we've come to know and love. How dare you give us more material? You must come up against that. There's the editorial, I think you were alluding to it, from A.E. Hotchner, that said, basically, Immovable Feast is what it is, and we can't corrupt the memory of the original book with other stuff.
Yes. Yeah. That Hotchner wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. It was very acrimonious about the new edition. But I have to say that's not entirely true. I mean, the book, and I think my grandfather, who was such a perfectionist about his writing, wouldn't have been comfortable really saying, well, that's that edition of A Moonwolf Feast, which was not finished by him, is presented as finished by him. I think that would have offended him, really. So I think the new edition, and both editions are available on Scribner's, and that was something I also wanted to point out about the Hemingway Library editions. We still have the other editions as well that Scribner's has put out for generations in some case, that are still available. So both the Hemingway Library editions and the regular editions, and the same is true for A Moonwolf Feast, so people can compare the two if they like.
Oh, is that right? So A Farewell to Arms, the paperback that we've used all these years, will always be extant?
Well, I obviously, in this world, the world of publishing and everything, you can't always say always, but I think, yes, I mean, it certainly is in print now. You can buy it now, and there's no plan at the moment for it not to be in print. And given the changes in printing today, now it's much easier to keep everything in print.
In looking at the Hemingway Library series, There's some notable omissions so far. And I think, for instance, Across the River and Into the Trees would be one that was published during his lifetime, and The Garden of Eden would be one that was published posthumously. Are either of those or both of those under consideration for the full treatment?
Well, yes, the series, at the moment, we don't have a next edition planned, but we're kind of at the moment where we're reviewing it and considering the next steps. So those would be obvious candidates, as you say. But at the moment, there isn't a publication date planned for either.
Yeah. We can segue to The Old Man and the Sea. As I said, it's a novella that always seems to be a touchstone, and it always seems to be a referent no matter what we are talking about. Why do you think it's so relevant these days? And I don't want to say more so than other Hemingway works, but certainly as relevant as other Hemingway works. It seems like The Old Man and the Sea, there's something timeless about it, that maybe The Sun Also Rises wouldn't quite have that that same eternal quality. Is that fair?
I think it does have a timeless quality to it. It really has almost an epic feel to it. And I think the subject is approachable for many people. The notion of an individual having this sort of epic battle with a fish on the sea, and fishing is perhaps more accessible to people than some of the other subjects of my grandfather, like that are touched on in Tunnel Surprises, like bullfighting or warfare. So yeah, I think it does. And I think the language also makes it very, I mean, that's true of his work in general, but The Old Man and the Sea, especially, it's a short book. And his language is so approachable, and yet the subject is also kind of so remarkable.
In thinking about The Old Man and the Sea, there's the relationship between Santiago and the boy. And that's something that, so I'm thinking about in Islands in the Stream, there's Thomas Hudson and as a father, and of course, some short stories too. And I wonder if when you think of The Old Man and the Sea, you think of Hemingway himself as a father or a patriarch, and how this novella might reflect that in some way.
Well, I think that I'm a fisherman myself. I love fishing, and it was something. It's a sport that was introduced to me by my dad, and my dad, of course, learned it from his dad. On the Pilar and out west and in Montana and Idaho and at Sun Valley and down in Florida and Key West. I think it is a kind of a sport. It's a sport that can be done with families, and it's a great way of building family traditions. So it's certainly a big part of the Hemingway family tradition.
When Hemingway famously says about The Old Man and the Sea, you know, the fish is a fish, there's no symbolism, the boy is a boy. Do you buy that? Do you think that there is a larger symbolic resonance that people have been coming back to? Or is it really a simple literal story, even a fable, that people have been coming to all this time?
No, I think there is a lot of symbolism in it. And I think he's being a little bit disingenuous there, because it really has plenty of symbolism. And the whole notion of, I mean, whether you think about it as a kind of a battle between a competition between a man and another animal. It doesn't have to be a fish or a man. Even it could be, you could see that in lots of different ways. And I think, you know, my grandfather had a love-hate relationship with critics and literary criticism. And so he often would, you know, take a counter approach to that kind of analysis of his work. But I think this work does, and it has this sort of feeling of the sort of endurance of man that's quite remarkable, and the ability for someone to overcome incredible adversity through their own abilities is remarkable.
So that point that Hemingway made about there's no symbolism whatsoever might be throwing the critics off the scent. What I was wondering if you were, the path you were going to go down is when that elaborate metaphor where Hemingway is accused of landing the marlin is the equivalent of writing a masterpiece, and the sharks in The Old Man and the Sea are just an elaborate metaphor for the critics that are parasitically, you know, gnawing at it. That might be taking it too far, or is there any substance to that?
Well, for me, I'm an art historian and a lover of ancient Greek literature, where also there are so many different strains of things. And so you take things to so many different levels. And so you can read it on one level, another level, another level. I think for my grandfather, the story really is a story about fishing. And it's so beautifully told, and it has these paradoxes in it, that you could catch the fish and lose the fish, and so it has all of these great elements of a story in it. And above all, I think he was a master storyteller. So, I don't think he would have thought of his literature in that way, but, you know, about himself versus critics. But I mean, although he did, you know, think about that as a person, he worried and thought about that, but. I think as he was writing it, he wouldn't have been writing it in that way. I think he would have been trying to do the best story he could have done.
Yeah. I think one thing about this edition that enhances the reader's understanding of The Old Man and the Sea is that you add as an appendix the Nobel speech. And so obviously not only is there definite connection between The Old Man and the Sea and the Nobel Prize, since it was cited specifically as motivating the committee to award him. But it also seems like some of the themes that Hemingway talks about in the speech echo some of the themes that are presented in the novella itself. Isn't that accurate?
I think, Mark, that's a great point, and I think it's very true. And that's where the speech is very short, but it does really echo the narrative of the novella. And I've got the edition here. I wonder if I could just read a passage from it. So here's a brief section. How simple the writing of literature would be if it were only necessary to write in another way what has already been written. It is because we have had such great writers in the past that a writer is driven far out, past where he can go, out to where no one can help him. And I think that really is referencing The Old Man and the Sea, and how Santiago is out there and he's doing what others have not done, and he's successful at it, but he also has this incredible hardship. And so I absolutely agree with you. I think he does see the novella as a kind of a metaphor for his work.
Sean, earlier in the speech, he says, each book should be a new beginning where he tries for something that is beyond attainment. So the great writer knows inherently that failure is beyond just being a risk, but it's inevitable if you try for something that is hard. And so, which begs the question, did Santiago succeed or fail? Was it a failure because he couldn't, you know, bring it home and sell it? Or was just the act of landing it a success in and of itself? And then how does that relate to the writer, you know?
Yes, no, it's a great point, and I think it's a mix. I don't think it's entirely success. It's a sad that he wasn't able to profit from his great achievement, but I do think that that's a theme in my grandfather's writing. I think he felt that really from very early on, that each book, you know, and he tried to do that. I think with each book, when you look at the books that he wrote, they really are in many ways, each one is different. And I'm thinking specifically where he states that very explicitly in Green Hills of Africa. He says, I'm trying for something different here, writing, if it's possible to write a work of nonfiction without to compete with a work of fiction. And I think he was trying to do that with Across the River and Into the Trees. And I think, you know, also For Whom the Bell Tolls. And one was very successful, one was not very successful. But in each case, I think he really was trying for a different, each one really has a different approach in some ways to the medium.
This also, to add on to your point, it also seems like, because this, The Old Man and the Sea and the Nobel Prize speech are in the wake of some of the criticism that Faulkner made of Hemingway, which is essentially that he just does the same thing over and over. And he doesn't have the courage to go beyond his happy zone. And I think there is no criticism that would have irritated Hemingway more than artistic cowardice.
Yes, no, I think you're right. And I think he would have been really happy with the quote we ended up using on the back of the cover, which is from Faulkner. It says, his best, I may show it to be the best single piece of any of us. I mean, his and my contemporaries. So Faulkner was a great fan of The Old Man and the Sea. And he was a man enough to admit that, you know, to despite their differences in other areas.
Yeah, that's a very good one. And one other aspect of the Nobel speech, which we can also loop back into the story, writing at its best is a lonely life. And there's a lot of moments during The Old Man and the Sea where Santiago is conscious that he is alone. He is not with the boy. He's not with any other. He's not with a team of fishermen. He's all by himself. And what he either has to fail or succeed, survive or die by himself. I'm also thinking of Big Two-Hearted River. So there's that aspect of fishing by yourself. That must have been a sacred, elevated moment for Hemingway.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a really good point. I think it is. It's a major part of fishing. It's something that you do by yourself, and is one of the great, I mean, it's for fishing, it's actually one of the part of the pleasures of fishing can be the, you know, the solace of it and the commuting with nature. But you're right. I think, and it may have been one of the things that attracted my grandfather to the sport. It's kindred spirit to writing.
Yeah. Unless they were of your party, they ruined it. Right. That's what he, that's how he views people. The old man, the thing that I learned about from The Old Man and the Sea was, where you added TypeScript, notations, things that Hemingway added to the TypeScript, which, I had seen, but I didn't know that there was even a previous draft that Hemingway had given away, which, I mean, maybe you can talk a little bit about that, from your introduction.
Yes. So typically with my grandfather, his writing process is that he often wrote a kind of a first draft, often longhand, sometimes typed. And we don't actually know the specific nature of this first draft of the Old Man and the Sea. But because it doesn't, we don't know what happened to it. And he gave it away right at the time, even before the book was published. He gave it to Gianfranco Ivančić, the brother of Adriana Ivančić, who was the inspiration of the heroine in Across the River into the Trees. And also she did the original artwork for the cover of The Old Man and the Sea. And she came to the Finca while my grandfather was writing The Old Man and the Sea. And she was a kind of an inspiration again for him, I think. But so we don't have this original manuscript. And so like we can see with say, For Whom the Bell Tolls, which came, or even more, perhaps most interestingly, A Farewell to Arms, where you have dozens of versions of the ending preserved in manuscript form. For The Old Man and the Sea, we really only have the last typescript, which has there are about 44 changes on it in his hand on the typescript. And they're mostly edits that strengthen the text mostly. But in an earlier draft, sometimes he'll cut things out, he'll add long passages, he'll expand. And so it's interesting to see that development in his process on those earlier drafts. And unfortunately, that draft at the moment is missing, and maybe it'll turn up.
So we don't know anything about it, whether it was there was hundreds of pages that he took out or whether it looks actually much like the TypeScript.
It's interesting. I mean, he wrote this novella really in a fairly short period of time. Originally, it was part of a much grander project. It was seen as a kind of epilogue to a three-part trilogy, basically, on the sky, the earth, and the sea. And so this was seen as kind of the epilogue to the sea book. And the sea book is what became Islands in the Stream, which was posthumously published. And so it's likely that actually there's not, you know, hundreds of pages, because this was written in a period of months, really, this book, although he thought about it for a long time. And the idea, he knew of the story and he thought about writing the story for a long time, because we know even as early as 1936, he wrote a, you know, short passage about it in a piece of journalism that he did for Esquire magazine, and a Gulfstream letter that he wrote for Esquire magazine. So it had a long period of gestation, but when he actually got down to writing, and I think it was just a shorter period. And there, while I'm sure there were changes to it, and it would be really interesting to see those, I don't think there would have been hundreds of pages different.
There's something about this novella that seems like it sprang from him, and it might not have been labored over as much as the others, which is, at least that's how it reads to me, which is why these 44 emendations are absolutely fascinating, right? He said Hota for the J. Just a little aside that is just part of the novella, but then you know it came in after the fact. It's fascinating.
Yes, no, it's amazing, and I think he had an incredible capacity for composition in his head. I think he was able to he's a person I think who had a kind of a photographic memory, and he was able to really work in his head and then write down, and he would do edits, but but it's amazing how clean some of his manuscripts could be. And you can see this also in some of the short stories.
Yeah, I want to mention one other thing about your introduction, which will refer back to some of the novella's relevance in these days. And you talk about the ecological theme that's running through and how Hemingway was obviously a lover of nature and the hunt and the fish. And I'm wondering if maybe the ecological element to The Old Man and the Sea means something different now than even it did when he wrote it.
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think as we see the ecology of the world in a state of collapse, I mean, people are talking about, you know, kind of a mass extinction and the number of animals, the species that are going extinct, and even marlin are on an endangered list. Marlin, which are the, I read and to my amazement at the Museum of Natural History in London a year ago, are the fastest fish in the sea we know of. Literally quite amazing. So I think, you know, and even just trying to, it's such a beautiful image that he portrays of the Gulf Stream and what it was like, and how Santiago understands so much of it. And he communicates that to us through the writing, you know, through Hemingway's writing, that we gain an appreciation for this, you know, for the sea and the Gulf Stream and get some understanding of this complex ecosystem and all the different kinds of creatures that are in it and how you can understand them and read the signs. In his case, to find the fish that he's fishing for. But there's also the balance of that these fishermen, local fishermen, are fishing on a smaller scale than fishing is happening today, in these small boats. I think one of the most remarkable images in this new edition is a photograph that I believe my grandfather took in 1955, around the time that they were making the movie for The Old Man and the Sea. And it's actually two old fishermen with a marlin in their boat, in their skiff. And it's the same kind of boat. It's as is described in The Old Man and the Sea. And it's fishermen from Coimara, the little village where Santiago fishes from. And there's the marlin, you know, it's the size of the boat. It's inside the boat. And there's two old guys with this. And it's kind of just amazing to see what these men were doing. But that kind of fishing was set up for catching a fish. And, you know, and the scale of it was within keeping of the ecosystem there. So they weren't fishing out like is unfortunately being done around the world now. And the pollution also that's happening into the oceans is terrible. And then we have climate warming and that effect on fish around the world. So, it's a story that we're not talking that long ago. We're really talking, you know, within many people's lifetimes, the changes that are happening, it's sad and kind of a call to, could be seen as a call to action.
And this may not relate to the environmental issues that you're talking about, but to me, it's what it makes me think of. And that is that Hemingway ends the novella with the tourists, the sort of obtuse dialogue of the tourists. And there, he must have been making some kind of a statement of outside intrusion onto some sort of holy experience that played out on a grander scale.
Yes. Yeah. No, it is a kind of a great irony at the end. Almost like the ending of The Sun Also Rises with the last sentence is sort of, and again, it's a playing on not understanding. They don't even quite realize that it's a marlin that they're looking at. And that's, I think that's true. And I mean, unfortunately, I think the kind of the knowledge that's embodied in this book is remarkable in that it's so accessible to people and it gives people a window into what the sea is like. You know, and for many of us who are not sea people, I mean, I'm personally more of a freshwater fisherman, and I've spent quite a bit of time in Greece on the sea. But you know, when you read that book and you see how you can understand all these signs, what for many people looking out at the sea just looks like this vast body of water, but actually it's this home to this huge body of life. And not understanding it is where people go wrong. And that's what can happen, I think, today with so much information out there good and bad information and not putting things together. And that's where he was such a gifted writer, where he could really get good information and put it together in a way that you understand it, and you can really have a vision of this remarkable ecosystem.
Oh yes, and to get into Santiago's mind, somebody who would have known every drop of that water and every aspect of it, it's just a tour de force, right? Just a masterpiece. The other element of this, of the volume, is that has been attracting a lot of attention, is the short story previously unpublished called Pursuit as Happiness. And I'm wondering if you could say a few words about that, about how it might enhance the understanding of the Old Man and Sea, or the time period, or Hemingway in general.
Yeah, so it's a wonderful, unexpected feature of this new edition, is this unpublished short story, Pursuit as Happiness. And it's a story that I came across at the Kennedy Library, and it was untitled. And we can thank my uncle Patrick Hemingway for the title, Pursuit as Happiness, which is actually taken from one of the chapter headings of Green Hills of Africa. And it's Hemingway's title, which echoes really the famous statement in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he changed it to Pursuit as Happiness, really. In Green Hills, it's expressing his great passion and interest in hunting. But my uncle aptly recoined it for this short story, which is all about the passion for catching a marlin, for marlin fishing and going after a huge marlin. And then what's so fascinating about this story is that it's not, it's actually a story that the characters in it are non-fictional characters. It's Ernest Hemingway himself fishing, a young Ernest Hemingway in 1933. And he's fishing with Carlos Gutierrez, who becomes his first mate on the Pilar, and whom he learned so much, or the man who first told him the story, basically, that is the story of the Old Man and the Sea. And Josie Russell, who's the owner of this ship, boat, the Anita, and he's also the owner of Sloppy Joe's Bar in Key West. So he's an old friend of Hemingway's from Key West. And it's a wonderful portrait of kind of Hemingway fishing that summer in 1933. And they go after this huge marlin, and they fish, for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then they keep extending it, hoping to get that the big fish are going to come. And then they actually get into a big fish. And kind of one of the remarkable things that I was wondering about this with this story, just how much of it is fiction, how much of it, because it really reads like a short story. It's really carefully crafted. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's not just about fishing for one fish. It's really about the whole passion of fishing. And to that end, it's the same, and it has many parallels really with the Old Man and the Sea, because it's not just the catching of a big fish. It's, the Old Man and the Sea isn't the old man and the big fish. It's the old man and the sea. And it's the same passion for Hemingway, for big game fishing. And this summer in 1933, they're trying to catch a fish and they lose this fish, but the fight for it is quite remarkable, and it's a fish of the comparable size to the fish in The Old Man and the Sea. The Old Man and the Sea is even bigger, kind of mythic fish, but this fish is close, is upwards of 1,000 pounds in the story, and always hard to tell when it got away how big it really was, but clearly it was a huge marlin. And what's amazing to me is actually the most recent edition of the letters, Hemingway's letters, the fifth volume, that just the complete letters just came out this summer. And in that is a letter that makes clear that the main story, the kernel of the main story of how the fish got away, which I'm not going to go into detail in case people read it, is described as in 1933 in a letter from Ernest Hemingway. So it actually, the every major part of the story is really true. And so this story really is a fascinating comparison to The Old Man and the Sea, because it's three men on a motorboat fighting a fish as big as the fish in The Old Man and the Sea, and the difficulties that they had, and they didn't bring it in. So I'm sure that fight wasn't it one of the inspirations, one of the many inspirations for my grandfather in writing the Old Man and the Sea. And it's And it's a wonderful image of him. And it's almost, I mean, I wondered how late the story was written, because it's hard to know when he, because he has, there are some things that make it clear that it wasn't written in 1933, but it must have been at least, you know, in 1935. And it could be as late as 1955, I think. But I really think now, I think it's probably as early as, it's probably around 1935 that he wrote it. And it's a very close accounting of an event that actually happened, with some flourishing. But he goes, he has daiquiris at the Floridita. He's staying at the Ambos Mundos Hotel. And, you know, so it's almost, it's just a sort of a wonderful image of him as a young man, living that life.
It's quintessential Hemingway, and it's a generous inclusion in the volume. Well, Sean, I wonder if we could end on the aphorism that seems like it's maybe the most quoted line in all of Hemingway. I know that's a probably an arguable quote from The Old Man and the Sea, that man can be destroyed but not defeated. And can we talk about that? Why that has, what that means to the novella, and what that might say about Hemingway's approach in his work?
Well, it is it's a fantastic quote in the book, and I think it does. It speaks, for me, it speaks to the resiliency of the human spirit. I think it really, you know, we've all get dealt different cards and lately how things land, but we people, you can't entirely crush the human spirit. And it has, I think, you know, it has general resonance, you know, in life. It has even more resonance today, I think, as we all are facing this, you know, worldwide pandemic of the COVID-19, and how we're all trying to get through this. And here's an example of a person by themselves, and we're all spending a lot of time by ourselves these days. And you get to know yourself and what you can and can't do. But I think the human spirit is an enduring thing, and I think it is a great statement.
Sean, this is Michael von Cannon. Regardless whether or not men can be destroyed and not defeated, computer batteries can certainly die, and it looks like Marx just did. So I want to end with, I guess, just a few follow-up questions from what you just said. You know, now that you've worked on this new Hemingway Library edition of The Old Man and the Sea, is there a sentence, a passage, a section of the novella that for you has taken on newfound significance?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I don't have a specific quote, but another my favorite parts of the book is when he talks about he thinks about lions and his time off the coast of Africa and so other parts of his life. And you think about people, solitary people who have had great experiences and draw on their experiences from earlier in life. And he does that through dreaming. I found, you know, recently being, you know, sheltering at home, you know, I've been doing mindfulness and these sessions and you think, and traveling to places that I've been and times that I've really have meant a lot to me. And I think it's very observant of Hemingway to, you know, to bring that into the story. He brings in these elements of the story that, although he's by himself on the sea and, or even in dialogue with the young boy, I mean, he lives a very simple kind of existence, but yet he's also had this rich life. And he draws on that as part of his strength. And I think that's very true for many of us, you know, in many parts of our lives change, but we have this rich well of experience. And I think it's also a leitmotif for my grandfather. I mean, you think also of A Movable Feast when he returned to that period at the end of his life. It's such a powerful time for him, and remembered those experiences so vividly in that book, in that memoir. That memory plays an important part for us, whether it occurs in dreams or whether it occurs in daydreams.
When we had John Irvin on to talk about his adaptation of The Garden of Eden, he was talking about how important it was to film those Africa scenes on location there at the border of Kenya and Tanzania. And yeah, I'm thinking about that while you're answering, but also I'm thinking about a response you gave a little while ago when you were talking about seeing a photograph during the filming of the adaptation of The Old Man and the Sea. And, you know, there have been a few different adaptations of this novella, whether we're talking about film or the recent A.E. and Tim Hotchner stage adaptation. Is there a particular adaptation that you feel has really helped you appreciate this novella in a new way?
For sure. And I think, I mean, it's interesting. I don't think my grandfather really, he cared for that so much. He never had a very strong relationship, I think, with the movies or really enjoyed any of the movies that were made of his work. I think it's really interesting to see those kinds of adaptations. And I think it's a lot of his work can adapt well to the screen or the stage. And especially because his dialogue is so powerful, but also the imagery. I think for The Old Man and the Sea, the most powerful adaptation I've seen is the short animation film that was done in 1999, and it won an Academy Award for Best Animated Short that year in Hollywood. And I haven't had a chance to see the Hotchner adaptation, but I bet it was interesting. And I think it would be interesting too, to do kind of a ballet. A ballet could be interesting too, to think about, you know, the battle or between the fish jumping and the fisherman and all of the moves and things that he has to do. So I think it's really interesting to look at art, you know, to look at art in different ways and through other media, such as theater and film and even ballet or music.
Sean Hemingway, thanks so much for coming on One True Podcast today and discussing your work editing the Hemingway Library edition of The Old Man and the Sea.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you, Mark. It's been a great pleasure to be here with you today to talk about the new Hemingway Library edition of The Old Man and the Sea, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on HemingwaySociety.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at OneTruePod. That's the number 1TruePod. Email us at OneTruePod@gmail.com or leave us a message at 321-209-1345. Our show is a production of the Hemingway Society and is supported by the University of Evansville and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time with Mark back and battery recharged, as we continue exploring Hemingway, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Michael Von Cannon with Mark Chirino, and this is One True Podcast.